This is December 30th, 2012, last Taisho of the year. And I'll be talking this morning about regrets and letting go of them without ignoring them, or ignoring what we may be regretting, habits. It's that time of year as we head into the new year and with repentance and resolutions for the new year. I'm going to be start by reading from another New York Times article by Benedict Carey. And this is from some a few years ago, but it's kind of timeless, I think. And the title of the article is "The New Year's Cocktail: Regret with a Dash of Bitters." And I'll, as usual, be skipping around a little bit. The article is framed in terms of New Year's regrets and resolutions, well, mostly regrets. But that's, I think, just how the author made it topical for the whatever day it was that it was printed in the Times. But he starts off talking about the night's humiliations after the morning, waking up the morning after New Year's Eve. And he talks about the traditional morning after descent into self-examination, that lonely echo chamber of what should and could be. I don't know how many people listening to this talk would be vulnerable to doing such things on New Year's Eve that they would wake up having real regrets. Surely there must be some, but I don't. Let's not get caught in, you know, New Year's Eve excesses. It's much bigger than just one night of the year. And then referring to this lonely echo chamber of what should and could be, he says ghosts roam around down there after all, and they are the worst kind, alternate versions of oneself. The one who did not quit graduate school, for instance. The one who made the marriage work. Or stuck with singing, playwriting, or painting and made a career of it. Lost possible selves, some psychologists call them. Others are more blunt. The person you could have been. Over the past decade and a half, psychologists have studied how regrets, large and small, recent and distant, affect people's mental well-being. They have shown convincingly, though not surprisingly, that ruminating on paths not taken is an emotionally corrosive exercise. I should think that anyone who's been has established a meditation practice would not question this. Ruminating on paths not taken is an emotionally corrosive exercise. But just to offer some corroboration of that fact, I'll continue. The common wisdom about regret, that what hurts the most is not what you did, but what you didn't do, also appears to be true, at least in the long run. Yet it is partly from studies of lost possible selves that psychologists have come to a more complete understanding of how regret molds personality. These studies in people recently divorced and those caring for a sick child, among others, suggest that it is possible to entertain idealized versions of oneself without being mocked or shamed. And they suggest that doing so may serve an important psychological purpose. one last paragraph before I comment on this. Researchers find that people think about past foul-ups or missed opportunities in several ways. Some tend to fixate and are at an elevated risk for mood problems. Others have learned to ignore regrets and seem to live more light-hearted, if less examined, lives. In between are those who walk carefully through the minefield of past choices, gamely digging up traps and doing what they can to defuse the live ones. Less examined lives is an allusion to this famous saying, the unexamined life is not worth living. That is a life without reflection, where we never stop and consider how we might avoid problems in the future. And part of that is looking back and acknowledging mistakes we've made, harm we've caused in the past. That's why Jukai, taking the precept ceremony, we always begin with the repentance verse, the repentance ritual. The idea being, once we can acknowledge pain-causing behavior in the past, then we can disavow ourselves of it and move on. But until we have seen it, then we're not going to be able to learn from it. And we have a way of avoiding things that habits, things, foul-ups, as he says, and ways that we cause other people pain, because it's painful to see the ways we cause others and ourselves pain. So the easier thing is just to forge straight ahead and not look back. But there is, of course, a place for looking back. And that's why the New Year's Eve ceremonies and festivities tomorrow night, after initial hunk of zazen, the it begins with the repentance ceremony, so we can sort of, clear away the past, and then move on. This point he makes, it is possible to entertain idealized versions of oneself without being mocked or shamed. Well, if we consider the very real possibility that is open to all of us for enlightenment, that is, a kind of Zen version of an idealized version of oneself. This is a possibility for everyone, without exception. And the trick is to honor that possibility without feeling diminished because we haven't realized it yet. I'll go on here. He cites a certain study from a couple of universities suggested that young adults who scored high on measures of psychological well-being tended to think of regretted decisions as all their own, perhaps because they still had time to change course. And this is interesting. By contrast, older people who scored highly tended to share blame for their regretted decisions. And then he quotes someone, "I tried to reach out to him, but the effort wasn't returned. So he suggests that with age, people apparently detoxify their regrets by reframing them as shared misunderstandings, a retrospective touching up that in many cases might have been more accurate. In a series of studies, Laura King, a psychologist at the University of Missouri, has had people write down a description of their future as they imagined it before a life-altering event, like divorce. She has found that those who are able to talk or write about this lost future without sinking into despair or losing hope tend to have developed another quality called complexity. Complexity reflects an ability to incorporate various points of view into a recollection, to vividly describe the circumstances, context, and other dimensions. It is the sort of trait that would probably get you killed instantly in a firefight, but in the mental war of attrition through middle age and after, its value only increases. Here's how a woman from Dallas described the impact of an early and devastating divorce. "I feel fortunate in a backhanded way to have experienced misfortune as a young woman. I feel it taught me humility and the ability to regroup. Life is good, but not lavish. It's hard work, and we have to give each other a hand once in a while." So this matter of complexity makes me think of one of the core aspects of Buddhist doctrine, which is the law of dependent co-arising. The law of dependent co-arising, he could do three teshos on it, but just to get to the gist of it, it means that there is no thing that stands apart from any other thing on its own and just happens without secondary causes and conditions. The wonderful, simple, concrete simile that the Buddha uses is, it's like two sheaves of reeds standing up in a field, or make it wheat. We all must have the mental image of those two sheaves of wheat or whatever standing up in a field. And the Buddha says, is the one on the left supporting the one on the right, or is the one on the right supporting the one on the left? Of course, the answer is neither and both. That they co-arise, that things happen because of multiple causes and conditions. If we can understand and appreciate this truth, and that's what it is, it's a truth. It's not just a bit of Buddhist dogma or doctrine. This is the way of life, of reality. Things co-arise. So a very painful, vivid, recent example would be in terms of gun violence. You hear people argue, it just kills me. People arguing about whether it's the easy accessibility of guns or whether it's mental illness. Which is it? Or other things as well. Recently, I was playing tennis with a guy in the police department, Rochester Police Department. This is right after the slayings in Webster, and I said something like, "Oh yeah, let's that's great. Let's have more guns available." Now I thought I was on safe ground because I've heard over and over that police departments generally are very much in favor of better gun control laws, at least assault weapons. So I said, "Yeah, let's have more guns available." And he cried out, "That's not it. That's not it. He said, you ought to see the number of guns in my safe. And then we went on and played tennis. but it's so, it's of course, it's not just the availability of guns he was suggesting. In fact, he did, now I remember, he did say something. There's all these nuts out there. Okay, that's the other strand in this. And then the third one, these are just the three major ones that people talk about, gun violence, mental illness, and then the culture of violent video games and violent movies and TV and so forth. That it's the co-arising of these things that has created this absolutely horrifying problem that we've got ourselves into in this country. Or that old thing, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Oh, how profound is that? So, all right, let's look at another one, weight loss. It's such a common issue for people, especially as we get older. It's not just the food we eat. It's also the exercise we get or we don't get. It's genetics to a degree from everything I've read. That's a factor. It's the co-arising of these things that is behind it. Who would argue against this core, bit of Buddhist teaching? That things co-arise. Or relationships. This is, I mean, personal relationships. The problem develops between a boss and an employee, or a teacher and a student. You can't say that it's just the boss, or just the employee, or just the teacher, or just the student. It's the co-arising. It's the two of them coming together. And not just the two of them, but the two of them coming together in that time, in that place, in that context. This is a way we can understand this word that the author here introduces, complexity. It gets us away from this simple, this simplistic idea of who's to blame. Is it me or is it him or her? I'll continue reading here. Dr. King has followed groups of people for years and found that this knack for self-evaluation develops over time. It is a learned ability. And then she says, to elaborate on loss, to look for some insight in it, is not just what a psychologically mature person does. It's how a person matures. That's what the studies show. So, yeah. I don't need to comment on that. It speaks for itself. Good therapists have long known the value of seeing regretted choices in the context of what has been gained as well as lost. A full-blown career in dance leaves little time for a family or much else. The reverse is also true, of course. Starting a family with that perfect someone at age 22 makes it hard to tour South America with a guitar on your back. And was he really so perfect? And then this Dr. Gary Kennedy, a director of geriatric psychiatry, said the idea is to move people away from this element of resentment, the sense that if only my parents this or I had done that, I would have what I want. That's a dead end. And this, the very first thing anyone could do to avoid this dead end is to take up the practice of daily meditation. these things arise, these kind of thoughts can easily arise during meditation. If only, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda. But then we see them, what happens? They disappear. They arise and they disappear. They move through the mind. They have no roots to them. I have to say that I don't hear Sangha members obsessing about what might have been, or obsessing about regrets they had from. I don't hear it in Doksan, I don't hear it outside Doksan. That doesn't mean that nobody has those thoughts. They just may not want to share them with me, which is too bad, because whether in Doksan or outside Doksan, just articulating to someone else, whether it's your teacher or someone else, just articulating the regret can help you move on. That's why, again, another reason we do the repentance ritual is to voice it. And then by doing so, in some way, mysterious way, it can help us, it can help free us from the past and let go of it. But resenting others for what might have been, or what we didn't do or weren't able to do, or whatever, this is so deluded. There's a line in a verse of the Mumonkan, the failure is wonderful indeed. What could he mean? What could Mumon, Zen Master Mumon, from the Chinese Zen Master Wu Men is his Chinese name, what could he have meant? The failure is wonderful indeed. That's the perspective that can open up for us in Zazen. How liberating to not have to go on with these mind-forged manacles, as William Blake put it, to shake these off and move on and live our lives instead of struggling under regrets. It happens. We don't have to sort this out mentally. We don't have to have a strategy. We just have to do Zazen, do daily meditation, and these things have a way of slipping off us. They just get quieter. These voices of regret get quieter and quieter, and we find that they just don't rear their heads the way they used to. It's in a way, it's the very essence of meditation is to be in the present, be fully present. I'm remembering a book can't remember if I commented on it in Taisho, called The Botany of Desire by Michael Pollan. In the book, he looks at the intertwining of four different plants with human destiny, and one of them is marijuana, and he links that to the human craving for intoxication, and he suggests that this timeless wish for intoxicants and be getting into an intoxicated state, whether it's alcohol or drugs, that this may be because it's as a way to help us be fully present. And as I remember, that did help me get in the present, is when I was stoned. But the trouble with that, one of the problems with it, is that it's not an adaptive, intelligent way of being present, because it's a way of just shutting out what might help us to reflect on from now and then. It is the unexamined life. It's a kind of a stupid numbing of oneself. Yes, we're in the present, but it doesn't alter the habits that cause us so much harm. We don't do the work. And meditation is different. And meditation gets us into the present, which is really the only reality there is. It's the present here. The rest is just thoughts. It does so while revealing to us our problems, our self-created problems, the way the misuse of the mind creates problems for us, suffering. I've come to appreciate more and more that Zen practice, and maybe all spiritual practice, is largely a matter of managing habits. Not just simple habits like overeating or smoking or whatever, but habits of mind, emotional habit patterns, habits of reacting to people and to situations that cause suffering, unnecessary suffering. I looked at back and noticed that in this past year, 2012, I did a Teisho on habit, and I won't repeat much of it at all, except just as a review of an important point of it. Habits, this is from another New York Times article of March of this year. It's called Habits, How They Form and How to Break Them. And it's kind of a review of a book by Charles Duhigg, Duhigg, as a business writer for the New York Times. And he talks about the three-part process that we could call the habit loop. That's what he calls the habit loop. And here's the three-part process. First, there's the cue, or the trigger, which tells your brain to go into automatic mode and let the behavior unfold. The second is the routine itself, the behavior. And the third is the reward, which is what helps the brain remember the habit loop in the future. And he makes a very strong case, this is based on research, of course, that if we can just change the cue or the trigger of the habit, then we have a much better shot at changing the routine, the behavior itself. And he suggests that, well, he cites evidence that going on vacation can sometimes help us break habits because it changes the cue. We don't have the cue when we're on vacation. We do things differently. Our routine is disrupted. We have a different routine maybe on vacation, but it got me to thinking, what is the ultimate vacation? Yeah, it's getting away from our thoughts. In a way, I would suggest doing Zazen is the real vacation, because other vacations, what we normally mean by vacations, going to wherever, somewhere warm in the winter, or what really changes there. Yes, we may be able to change some habit, but then we come back, and then more often than not, things we come back to our problems and our issues. Whereas with Zazen, we take a vacation, yes, from these thought processes, that these habits of thought that keep tripping us up. One of my Dharma heirs, Sante Paroma, who is co-leader of our sister center in Scandinavia, Sweden and Finland mostly, Sante Sensei was a heavy smoker before his first sesshin. His first sesshin here was a 4-day sesshin, and he broke it completely. He hasn't smoked since that first 4-day sesshin. And that's unusual. I've learned that from others that smoking is a tenacious habit, very difficult to break. But I think this is where the cues were severed. His ordinary cues or triggers for that habit, and he was able to leave it behind. But sesshin is just a kind of an intensified version of zazen. It's just an extended zazen. So in our daily zazen, by detaching from thoughts, we're in this space where change is possible, or change, I don't just mean behavior, because while you're sitting, you're not making any bad habits other than the thoughts that keep cycling through the mind. But it gives us some space and distance from the thing, and insight into it. Seeing our habits, our mental habits and other habits, seeing them as insubstantial. They don't have any substance to them. And they start with thoughts. There is this profound statement by the Buddha. The most common translation I've run across is sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. But the one I prefer now, another translation of this, or version of it anyway, is thought manifests as word, word manifests as deed, deed develops into habit, habit hardens into character. So it begins with thoughts. The degree to which we cling to our thoughts or not. That's why meditation is the most intelligent. I won't say this with any apology or qualifying it. It's the most intelligent way of finding change in our lives, changing the mind. Because our experience of reality is determined by the mind. It's not primarily the circumstances of our lives or the conditions, painful circumstances. Of course, that is another factor that can't be ignored, but it is how we respond to these causes and conditions, circumstances, and that we can change and go on changing, on and on and on, through working with the mind. and we keep getting another chance at these habits. We keep, every breath is new. Every breath is a way of resetting. There's a very interesting story that I read in Sesshin in July about Picasso. Arthur Rubinstein there was an interview in a magazine called High Fidelity Magazine, an article with an interview of Arthur Rubinstein in which he relates an encounter he had with Pablo Picasso. The question is, how does Rubinstein maintain his constantly fresh outlook, which makes familiar music sound as if it had been written only the day before? And then this is Rubinstein's answer. He begins by saying, this question I must answer by relating a lesson I once learned from Picasso. He was friends with Picasso. They used to see a lot of each other. One day, Rubinstein visited him, and he relates here that for some months he saw Picasso stand in front of his easel and paint a bottle of sherry, a table, a guitar that was lying around, and some banal ironwork on the balcony. He says, I saw about 50 canvases of those same objects. I became a little impatient and also a little bored. I wanted to see a new Picasso. So one day I said, look here, Pablo. What is the matter with you? Aren't you getting tired painting day after day always the same things? Well, I saw a furious glance at me. He became really angry. What rot are you talking to me? What stupid things are you telling me? Every minute I'm a different man. Every hour there is a new light. Every day I see that bottle with a completely different personality. It is another bottle, another table, another life, in another world, and everything is different. This is the kind of seeing that we don't have to just leave to artists. It's through daily meditation that we have this ability to see things afresh. Everyone knows, it's most obvious after a long sesshin, a 7-day sesshin, who doesn't know the experience of coming back to your family, your spouse, your children, and after a 7-day sesshin and see how different, how fresh and new and unstuck they appear. So of course, because we're less stuck. That old thing, the eyes and the beauties in the eye of the beholder. Well, so is newness and freshness. Just a last paragraph here in this article by Benedict Carey about regrets. Even the perspective from which people remember slights or mistakes can affect the memory's emotional impact, new research suggests. A recent Columbia study found that reimagining painful scenes from a third-person point of view, as if seeing oneself in a movie, blunted their emotional sting and facilitated precisely the sort of clear-headed self-perception that Dr. King described. Okay, how do you do that? How can you find a third-person point of view as if seeing oneself in a movie? You know how. By doing zazen, detaching from thoughts, becoming one with the breath, with the koan, whatever one's practice is, We come to see ourselves in this detached, depersonalized way, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Then we're not identified with this old, stuck self who we imagine ourselves to be. There is no self. There is no fixed, self-standing self disconnected from everything else. It's an illusion. What we call the self is it's this shimmering illusion. It's like a hologram. These images, these three-dimensional images that are just the interplay of light, lasers in a certain fashion. Or the ancient metaphor is the bubbles. It's like bubbles in a dish pan. They're in complete flux. They're breaking up constantly. This is the real nature of what we call the I or the me. The other thing that comes up for all of us, I suppose, if we're thinking in terms of New Year's resolutions, is the matter of will. Here too, I gave a teisho earlier this year about willpower and the limits of willpower, and there was actually two studies that presented different kinds of conclusions. The first was that our willpower is finite; that we have a certain tank of willpower that then gets diminished, and after using it a lot, after strong physical exertion or spiritual exertion like Sesshin, and then it gets depleted and has to be replenished somehow over time. That was the first study or series of studies. A later one, here I'm just again summarizing so I don't repeat too much of what I already gave a whole teisho on. The later one found that yes, there is this effect of our willpower being depleted, but only if we believe it will be. So in the second one, they addressed the results of the first one, but then they built on that, and they found that, and I don't need to go into any kind of specifics, don't have the time to, but they were working with college students and others in various studies, that they various experiments, that the if they believed that willpower was would be depleted, that it's finite, then that's what they found. But if they didn't, and this matches my experience in Zen practice, and I think the master's experience, is that what we call willpower, is like a muscle that we can develop, we can strengthen our willpower. If they could buy into that, then the study showed that they didn't have diminished willpower. This is very important. Because in a way, this is the engine, our will or volition, to use another word. The Buddha famously said, "It is mental volition, O monks, that I call karma. Having willed, one acts through body, speech, or mind." That's how it is initiated. We make a resolve. We make a resolution, a New Year's resolution. It is all important that we have that, without thinking that that's everything. Because remember, the law of dependent co-arising, it is willpower, but it's not willpower alone. It's the environment, it's the situations we choose, we will ourselves into, the people we associate with, the conditions of our body, our mental or physical health. All of these are other things that co-arise with the will, the resolution. But it can't dispense with this will, this volition, this resolution, this resolve. And that's why we so often recite the four vows together, as we will now. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.